afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you might be in the world, to episode 54, Eric, of Running Into the Fog. Can you believe we've hit 54 already with this thing?
Doesn't feel a single episode past about 24, yeah, actually. Well, feels like it's been half that many.
Episode 54 already on the fog. And you know, sometimes you folks listening in or listening to the recording, you have a chance in life to meet somebody that you just kind of connect with. I'm at my core a connector of people. I like to connect people to one another and watch those relationships flourish. And occasionally I connect with people where there's a really deep bond that is created in the process. I hope that with our guest today, I can be a connector of you with him. To speak just for a second about the bond that's been created between our guest and myself, I'm going to take you back about 9 or 10 years. And you're going to be hearing from three fathers. I think between the three of us, we have 10 children. Family is just as important to the three of us as our professional aspirations, I think it's fair to say, right, guys? And when you think about the pursuit of accomplishments, education, knowledge, achievements in your professional life, you have to weigh that against the realities of what that's going to mean, sort of opportunity cost, and a whole other host of variables to your personal life. And I remember having with our guest this conversation 9 or 10 years ago. His kids at the time were maybe 6 and 4. And he was talking about, Derek, I know you have this thing called the Chartered Financial Analyst, the CFA designation. I'm thinking about doing that. You remember this conversation, Todd?
I remember it like it's yesterday.
By the way, welcome, Todd Tomlick. Great to have you on the show today.
Welcome, thank you, Todd, for having me, and great to join you both.
So this story, we're having over lunch, and Todd says, you know, I'm a forecaster. I do a lot of financial analysis. I'm thinking that I should go after this CFA. And I said, well, how old are your kids? And he said, 6 and 4. You know, I think that's essentially what we arrived at, right? And I said, you know, do you really understand how much time you're going to have to sacrifice away from them to put in the amount of work? You know, this is not a designation for the faint of heart, and those that have it understand what I'm talking about. And I essentially talked you out of sitting for that. And I don't know, you might someday regret that, but I know that conversation was meaningful to you. It was meaningful to me. And I think it was one of those moments in our relationship, Todd, that it really was kind of defining in the sense that it was a bond on that particular topic that could even carry us forward 9 or 10 plus years.
That's right.
What do you remember?
We're, you know, we are humans first. And I remember that. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, just because that did shape the decision I chose, because I put a lot of weight on, you know, what your perspective is. It also shows, you know, kind of how important it is to see the underlying person behind, you know, kind of the broader picture of decisions that they're making when you're thinking about what path they may choose. But yeah, value your opinion a lot and your perspective. And obviously that has not changed this many years forward, and have still used that principle since in making other choices too.
Well, good. I'm really glad to hear that. You know, just it's important. We get one shot. So I have an old friend who's actually been on this podcast, Evan Weston. He says it this way: life is not a dress rehearsal, and the greatest thing we can become masters at is deciding which things we pursue, personally and professionally, and which ones we sacrifice. That whole select and sacrifice transcends professional ambitions, but also dips into the personal thing too. So let's get into this, Todd. Your background: you are an award-winning, Federal Reserve award-winning forecaster. You spent predominantly all your time forecasting the world around building products, housing starts. That's what you do for your living. Can you share with our audience a little bit about your background, how you got from, you know, Todd growing up to the Todd that we see on the podcast today, just to give some context to kind of who you are, where you reside, how you think, that type of thing, to get us started today.
Sure. Yeah. So I in case everyone's wondering, I live in Wisconsin, in Green Bay. Have kind of always grew up in the area around Green Bay. My wife's not from this area, but I'm fortunate enough to have her, and actually her family moved to this area too, so we're still here. Professionally, I've been, you know, in the industry for about 17 years now. But I started out in banking, spent a couple of years in banking, and we had a new baby come along the way, and the company that I was working for got bought up by another bank. And so a friend of mine who is a physicist who specialized in gray water research was working at Kohler Company at the time, and he knew this role that had to do with trying to think about forecasting different parts of plumbing demand and how, you know, how will consumers choose for one type of product versus another, and what's going to happen with housing. And he threw my hat in the ring. I took that role. It was very different than anything I did within banking, even though there was some overlap because we had touched, you know, some housing and real estate things before. That was in October of 2007, which, if you remember the timing of October, if you're building a model that predicts when the recession started, it was October of 2007. So that was a really fascinating time to get into the industry of forecasting and market measurement. And when I joined, Kohler is a wonderful company. I have just tremendous respect for them in every way. But at that time, the role that I had was also including measuring who was gaining and losing position in the market across a whole bunch of different spectrums, which is especially important to measure when the floor is falling, which is obviously what happened in the next few years. So I learned by getting my teeth kicked in and rolling up my sleeves, you know, on the ground. Education background, I'm a pure math guy in my heart. I was a minor in econ, which I think is really useful. I can talk about more of that later on. But I tend to approach things from much more of a pure problem solving basis, meaning there's things that we can infer that exist that might influence how we think about the future or our forecast, that maybe apply more to how someone with a math background would look at them versus how someone with, you know, just a pure play econ background might think about the space. And I was fortunate to be trained by a really brilliant economist. His name was Manuel Gutierrez. Still keep in touch with him. He did change my perspective about certain economic truths that I believed were truth, just because I had been taught that, you know, coming out of school and in banking. And it was a really great experience, especially coming into, you know, what we're into right now, which is just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. So, yes, as you alluded to, since that point, continue to participate in the Federal Reserve forecast. I think I'm going to win. You know, don't count your eggs until they hatch. But I think this is the year that we may just win inflation and the dollar and a number of other categories. I think oil too, which is great because that's not something that I particularly specialize on. But it's leveraging the perspective of many people who have, you know, been important in my life, like you have, to help me, you know, just continue to dial in the thinking process. But that's the quick background on me.
When you say win, do you get to have like lunch with Jerome, or what do you actually win?
No, there is nothing except your name on a spreadsheet, and, you know, among those who are invited to participate, which is a nice group. Essentially you have to do a quarterly forecast. So it's not just the number, but it's the path. And those who are closest in calling, like the course over the, you know, over the course of the year, they feel good for the year, and then they have to re-up the next year. So we'll see how it goes. But it just means that I'm less wrong. We're all wrong, but just less wrong in those things, you know, by chance this year.
That's why they call it an estimate, right? Is that we know it's wrong. It's not a forecast. It's really an estimate about how correct can we try and make it. And it's interesting that you mentioned inflation, because as I think of inflation, I'm an Austrian economist by, you know, mindset. So I think of it in terms of the money supply and the growth of the money supply. I knew there was a problem in late 2020 when the Fed decided to stop publishing the data around M2. And as that data was no longer available, I thought, oh boy, here we go. They're gonna blow this thing up, and with it, our buying power, which is really how I think most consumers think of inflation. Is most consumers think of it as how much can I buy with this dollar, which is clearly, you know, pretty deleterious from a year ago. And if I had to sort of make my own estimates as the history undergraduate in the crowd, not the math guy, by the way, I'm thinking about historical trends and what might happen next. Most likely, there will continue to be inflation in those things that we need, our necessities, and deflation in a lot of the things that are more sort of convenience and consumer good related. So I don't know. Is that your estimate also, Ted?
Yeah. So here's what I think right now, and obviously we'll continue to learn. I think that where people are coming to thinking about what's coming into next year, they tend to reference what they remember, which is 2007, 2008, and they don't want to go through 2007, 2008 again because they're afraid of that. Well, this isn't that at all. And then they reference the most recent inflation run-up, which would have been, you know, the one in the data from the 70s and 80s, because it's convenient and everyone, you know, has a family member that's touched it in some way. This is not that at all either. And I actually think that there's a degree of complacency regarding, you know, the role that, you know, the destabilizing role that inflation plays in how people make decisions, in global coordination. Probably the most similar, you know, and we can point to other examples, but, you know, at the core, you know, I'll pick on what you said, Eric. You know, we don't buy, if I buy another product, I really buy, if I'm a baker, I buy it with bread. I baked a bunch of bread, I exchange it for money, and I can exchange the money for whatever product I bear. And what inflation does is it makes it really hard for that coordination to happen. Now we make a bunch of bread. It may or may not, based on the price signal, be the right amount of bread. And when I get the money, I may or may not be able to get for what I really, and now with all the delays that we're running into, the other like core problems with coordination, I may purchase something that I may not be able to get for a year. That might be a deal breaker. And that all shows up as risk, very, very foundational in a bunch of ways. So I think there's a little bit too much complacency around, you know, the kind of spectrum of outcomes coming into 2023. Very positive about, like, you know, housing in the long run, especially remodeling in the long run. That's not the focus of this conversation. Probably more cautious than most on the economy because of what you allude to.
Yeah, I was going to add to that we haven't had a $31 trillion national debt to service back in the 1980 when, you know, we last saw inflation at these levels. And, you know, I think that's what, 140% of GDP? Or something like that from a ratio. I don't know what it was in 1980, but you might.
Yeah, the you know, best looking horse in the glue factory, right? Is the analogy where actually the case, you know, like this period that I keep looking at more and more closely, and I know there's differences, but is the period immediately after World War I, 1918 to 1920, which is really interesting because we saw emergency wartime spending for the first time. We saw for the first time really, really expansion of the national debt. A brand new wet behind the ears Federal Reserve, which was started in 1914, dealt with inflation for the first time. And, you know, and there was this belief coming out of the Great War that, you know, the end of wars, it must have felt a lot like it did in 2020. When we saw, you know, businesses stop and expected, you know, just absolute carnage, there was about a 6-month window after November of 1918 when gross domestic product fell by 3% because all these canceled, you know, defense orders. And so, you know, when I look at that period, there was this, you know, period that happened after that because of all this credit creation where we saw consumers continue to power through. They bought. In 1919, it was a huge year, but there was weird product delays and shortages because you can't take the means of production and force it to be something else and then try to consume the same way you would before. It shows up as much higher prices, which is exactly what we saw then and we see now. And then you ran into a situation where you saw double-digit inflation, regardless of how you measure it. And you had a brand new wet behind the ears Fed, which didn't have a dual mandate at the time, crank up interest rates. You know, it's funny. I see social media posts where they talk about, you know, prognosticators saying that the Fed is increasing rates at a faster pace now than they ever have. Absolutely not true. It happened in 1919, October 29, 1919, at the same pace as what we see right now. And not that this is a forecast, but it caused an outright modest but significant depression. with prices dropping 20%, they caused outright deflation. Dow dropped 40%. There was very significant social events, riots, terrorism on Wall Street. And then things bottomed out relatively quickly. So, you know, now we have a situation where rates are going up just as fast as they did then, but you're not going to see, any appetite for outright deflation to be supported or allowed. So we're going into a situation where the end game is very different, and we have to kind of think about where that goes. But I think, you know, by the way, housing was the golden child during, you know, post 2020 and 2021. There's a whole reason why we look at housing as, especially amid the roaring 20s, as being in Florida, one of the most unique places to park your cash. Not saying that's going to happen now at all. That's not a forecast, but we have to learn from history, and we're getting into a pretty unique circumstance.
Todd, you speak about Manuel's impact on you, you know, and what you learned from him at, you know, this great company called Kohler Company. From there, you went and you spent, what, 7 or so years at a real estate consulting firm, you know, honing your craft, if you will. And now you're at another company known as Zonda. Can you talk about kind of what I'd love to hear a little bit more about is how you think the Kohler Company prepared you for those next journeys in your professional career? And, you know, speak a little bit about that path, because we always have listeners coming out of this podcast who might be thinking about doing something else, and they might be inspired by your story. And, you know, we've had that happen before on this podcast. So can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So there's a phrase that you will all be familiar with, which is embrace the suck, right? And that's
Eric, not to interrupt you. Eric has a shirt. He's worn that on this podcast before.
As a matter of fact. Yep.
So, you know, I think what I would mention there is, now Kohler Company is a phenomenal company, but imagine having the job of trying to forecast and measure what's happening within the market in a situation where the data is just incredibly poorly measured. And the results of what you put on paper will very personally impact many people within the company. You know, it'll impact their families. It'll impact, you know, the next year for them. And therefore it impacts the relationship that you have with them as you're working on. And you have a job being unbiased and saying what you believe is truth. In the Great Recession, that's a formula for having plenty of opportunity to embrace the suck. And so what I basically got to experience in that was taking a fresh approach at looking at really important questions in a circumstance that most people in that had never been through. I don't think there's anyone that was alive that was through the Great Depression at that time. And when I was in banking, there was, but not at Kohler in the same role. And it helped me understand what questions were important. I think, you know, the ability to identify very valuable and important questions and then plot your course to answering those questions is underrated. People tend to, you know, take existing data that they have because it's convenient. They build a model because they feel like by building a model that they'll have somehow, you know, added rigor or adding some sort of perspective, which is important to use. But neither of those guarantee that you're asking the right question. So what Kohler did, which was very, very smart, they spent a lot of time making sure that we were measuring the right parts of the market very, very strategically, you know, and allowed us to basically logic, just similar to chess, actually, you know, if these three moves happen, what does that imply for this type of product at this price point 3 years from now? What does that mean? And if this doesn't happen, then what does that mean? And so that logical framework, And the training that I received, you know, fortunately with Manuel that you mentioned, really challenged how I constructed problems, and I carried that with me forward. So I'm in a very different role now than I was at that time, but embrace the challenge and be open to throwing away how you framed up solving problems before and potentially learning a new approach. That was very valuable, and I still see it today. People are very quick to take convenient data, slap a model against it. It's especially interesting using AI and some of these new tools that are out there. People get so bamboozled by the fact that they've used a complicated tool, which is great, but that doesn't mean you've asked what's important. So focus on the question that's important.
I was going to say that most forecasting is palliative. It makes us feel more comfortable while we're getting killed, as opposed to actually being predictive and helping us chart a path forward where we can cope with these changes and the changed understanding of reality. And I think the term black swan became a very popular one after the great financial crisis, because it was the only way most thinkers could explain this, you know, really rare set of circumstances that confronted us at the time, which was really just another liquidity crisis. It was a bunch of people got margin called and they had to liquidate assets in order to cover their calls, their shorts. And that's probably what's going to happen again in terms of, you know, what the next meltdown looks like. There's more leverage in the system now than there was in 08. And I think that if you look at the derivatives, you know, we're talking $100 quadrillion worth of derivatives out there, or some astronomical number. I can't even count the
way
zeros.
Too much complacency. What you're describing is a recipe for way too much complacency coming into 2023. Right. Yeah.
It feels like nothing unusual is happening, which is exactly what kills you, is all of a sudden the wheels come off, the rules change, and you know, you're no longer driving a motor car anymore. You're, you know, trying to fly.
There's a data point that's funny that you say that. There's a data point that I like to look at, and this is one that anyone can look at, right? So go prove it to yourself. But you know, the University of Michigan consumer sentiment, which are like okay, they're good measures, but really from a practical standpoint, they're not very forward looking. Like consumers are not very good at kind of predicting what's going to happen a year out, kind of as you're alluding to. But even that being said, if we look at questions on like just how well consumers smell out smoke in the air, the percentage of consumers that think it's a good time to buy a home or to buy things that are in the home have never been lower in the history of the data. And I don't mean like we're marginally lower. I mean, we look at what happened in the 70s and 80s, and we are an order of magnitude worse today than we were at any point during, you know, those prior, which implies that, you know, an outlier among outliers should cause us to immediately kind of put on our radar of worry and realizing that there's something that we misperceive. You go to Starbucks, you order a latte and they bring you a whiskey, right? At a certain point, you better step back and make sure that your frame of reference is right. You may not be in a Starbucks at all. You could be in some place that's nefarious and you don't like what's going to come next because it could get dangerous. And so what we're seeing in the data is like lots of whiskey right now. And people are, because they're convinced they're still, you know, coasting along and they're seeing revenue being okay. We don't want to see inventories pile up with leverage, as well as we're, you know, at the same time as we're seeing a lot of coordination issues. That's a recipe for, you know, really unusual things to happen quick, which is, I'm totally with you there.
Well, and we have been talked into this idea that, you know, employment is as strong as it's ever been, 3.5%. A 40-year low or whatever that stat was a week or so ago. And all I could think was, yeah, because you've got people getting a third job in addition to the second job to make ends meet. So many people dropped out of the workforce. And here's sort of macroeconomically my sort of take on what's going on right now. We saw 1 million people die with COVID, with whatever, however you define that. You've got another couple of million people who've got long COVID circumstances, which basically disable them more or less permanently. They're no longer a part of the workforce. And then you've got a couple million people who've had bad reactions to various of the therapeutic strategies that have gone along with that response to COVID. By my count, that's about 5 million workers out of the workforce, more or less permanently. That labor gap is going to be a couple generations.
Yeah.
To close. Yeah. This isn't the kind of thing that closes because you raise the minimum wage to $20 an hour. You're not going to close that labor gap like that.
And we'll be bamboozled because what you allude to is a productivity problem, right? There's only so many people that create, you know, that create goods and services and things that we can actually buy and sell. And it can be papered over by a focus on the unemployment rate and the prices, which make it look like things are relatively healthy. we still have this big mismatch of coordination because of the productivity problem. Factor productivity is getting worse. People need to, like, this is a real problem. I'm absolutely, I don't view myself as an alarmist, but the fact that more people are not pointing to, it's funny. There's a guy named Skousen, underrated, came out with a, the reason that we think about like recessions behaving that the way they are is because of this framework that's been penciled in, 90 years ago around how to think about GDP, this consumer spending plus government spending. And then you have this residential and, investment and these other components, inventories, things like that, balance of trade. But he made a really nice point, which was that excludes, that's only in end goods and services. It excludes all the productive structure of how you make goods and services, things like mining, which is not counted in any of the GDP statistics because it's not an end good and service or at least intermediate stages. The BEA now finally, because of Skousen, began publishing GDP by industry, which counts those earlier stages. And it shows a number to the economy that's twice as large. We're not talking about a $20 trillion economy. It's twice as long. It's $40 trillion. And that's where the mismatch is. It's all in the deep upstream where the goods and services actually get produced, because investment, especially, long-term investment, takes time before you know if you made money or you lost money. And so what I worry about with, big swings in interest rates and big swings in prices and problems with coordination is that it's just really, really hard to make the right call. If you're investing in something, say, as difficult as like a mine for, raw commodities or raw materials, you may not know if that was the right call for several years. And your price assumption was penciled in 2 years ago, and it's way different than it is today. And your cost of capital is very different than it was, 2 years ago. It's way different today. And you thought you could put it on a container ship 2 years ago, and you turn out that you can't, at least not without a whole lot of risk. And so what I think we could run into a situation is that the headline end goods and services, this is like, looks okay, but it's just harder to get real goods and services to work, which generally is a hit to profitability. And we saw this after COVID. We can't all stay home on Amazon and order products and expect other people to go out and deliver them and make them. And we'll kind of just defer the risk to, that's a kind of a very myopic view of how things work. I'm with you. I think that, the problem we have is that in order to consume, like we've consumed, say anything pre-2020 requires very efficient coordination of capital. And by the way, as trade gets more difficult, the U.S. is a huge beneficiary in the sense of, we probably have to take a 20th of the reduction in quality of living and the types of goods and services we can actually acquire with the same amount of dollars as what other countries have to deal with. So this means that those other countries that are being exchanged with, your counterparts in them are going through much more difficult, and people tend to make poor decisions when they're under duress. So this is a recipe of just a whole lot of unusualness coming into 2023.
Well, thank goodness for the petrodollar, at least for the moment, as it will probably help us Americans to enjoy a slightly softer landing. Speaking of soft landings, I have to say this first 30 minutes has really flown by. We're through the unthinkable portion, and we have to say goodbye to our friends on social media. So for those of you who haven't had a chance yet, scan that QR code, get over and register, and then join the bridge and become an interlocutor in the second half. Our first interlocutor is Mr. Terry Thiel. He's going to be coming on here in a second. Derek, would you ask a final question during Unthinkable with Todd? And I'll get Terry lined up to join, and we'll turn Todd over to Terry here and see what those two can come up with.
That sounds good. So, Todd, I've got a 16-year-old in my house, too. Doesn't have his driver's license yet. Is your oldest a girl or a boy?
My oldest is a boy, and he's close to getting the license and not there yet.
Close. Yeah, I'm about 6 weeks away from my best estimate. And I'm wondering, you've dropped such wisdom on us about forecasting. Do you ever apply that to your kids? And especially thinking about, sharing such wisdom in forecasting how one new driver might overcome certain driving conditions and forecast a good outcome versus a bad outcome. I'm trying to kind of bring this back to the fatherhood theme that I started with. Any suggestions for me?
One of the big errors that we probably make in forecasting and young drivers make is kind of this decision by inertia. My reference point is what business conditions and sales were yesterday, and therefore that's what I can assume that will be tomorrow. And, you know, we all realize the wisdom and kind of looking and seeing that a storm cloud coming on the horizon means that you should probably be more cautious. And especially if there's a, you know, and this was in Wisconsin, a freezing storm comes in, you may not want to be on the road at all, know when to park it in the garage. So, you know, what I'm trying to encourage him is just be very thoughtful about when to engage. And it's okay to sometimes choose to avoid engaging altogether if you're uncertain about kind of what those foundational input conditions would have to be for things to be where you want, you know, to be okay.
Yeah, that's an excellent. Eric and I have an uncle who's now kind of a retired recreational pilot, and he always said takeoffs are optional, but landings are mandatory. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about here. You know, your takeoff in a car is sometimes optional, and yet if you go out there, you're going to have to hopefully come home safe and sound.